motion. The murder of politician Rafiq Hariri led to the Cedar Revolution. Looking back at the mysterious poisoning of Viktor Yushchenko right before the Orange Revolution of 2004, we see now that he became a sacred victim himself. Most political analysts believe the compassion of the Ukrainian people at that moment tilted the scales, giving him the presidency. The number of victims among the protesters during Euromaidan totaled over 100. They are called the Heavenly Hundred. All the sacred victims were immediately mythologized. The beating of students on November 30th, 2013 was the obvious trigger of Euromaidan. Those who sent trained provocateurs to the square very well realized that peaceful protesters were the ones who would get hurt the most. It's hard to keep protests going for months on end. Tensions subside, and people inevitably get tired. Holidays are also a big danger for revolutionary masterminds. People want to be home with their families and friends, and one needs to get inventive to keep people in a cold, tense city. On Christmas Day of 2013, tabloid journalist and political wannabe Tatiana Chornovol was chosen to become the tool to whip the protests on Maidan back up.
A civic activist and journalist known for investigating corruption among senior officials was beaten outside Ukraine's capital on Christmas.
Her heroic deeds as a reporter looked more like petty crimes, trespassing on the presidential residence of Viktor Yanukovych, leading a rioting crowd to seize the Kiev City Administration building, breaking into a car of the Security Service of Ukraine. It looked like Tatiana was more interested in making news than reporting it, and gaining name recognition that could be turned into votes for her struggling political career in the opposition party Fatherland. She gave the world media a Christmas present in 2013, when she was cruelly beaten by unknown assailants on the road. Despite the fact that in just 3 days all the suspects were arrested and confessed to beating Tatiana during a road rage incident, world media kept insisting upon the political background of the crime. Instantaneously, Tatiana became a heroic martyr, uniting people around her image.
The beating coming amid political turmoil in Ukraine, this has drawn a protest.
Euromaidan was once again center stage, and Tatiana, in less than 2 months after the assault, she was already healthy enough to attack the office of Party of Regions, the party of Viktor Yanukovych. One of the staff members, 65-year-old IT specialist Vladimir Zaharov, was killed during the attack. So, where is Tatiana now? Well, she finally got her position of power in the new government. 1 month later, the time for another act in the play came. Armenian-Ukrainian protester Sergei Nigoyan was one of the first to arrive at Maidan. He wasn't radical or violent, but instead naive and full of hope. Watching Sergei read a patriotic poem is like watching a casting tape for the role of a sacred victim. Unfortunately, Sergei got the part. Betrayed by his brothers in arms, this video would eventually go viral after Sergei was killed early in the morning of January 22, 2014. The circumstances of his death remain unknown to this day. Even though the whole area of protests was heavily filmed at that time, there were no records or witnesses to help the investigation, and his body was moved immediately from the scene of the crime. Sergei became the first killed martyr of Euromaidan, and in a heartbeat, the police officers were appointed as his killers. Almost 2 years later, the official investigation would still deliver no results. Now, it is widely believed that Nigoyan's murder was staged by provocateurs to escalate the conflict. God speaks to people with the language of signs. On January 26, 2014, Pope Francis prayed for Ukraine, addressing thousands of people at St. Peter's Square in Vatican City.
Padre, et filius, et spiritus sanctus.
After the prayer, two white doves were released from the papal window and were immediately attacked by a crow and seagull. Those who understand the language could easily read the meaning of this omen. Soon, great forces, the seagull and the crow, would be tearing apart two Slavic nations, the white doves. This omen gave hope to the Ukrainian people, saying that by God's will, the doves would be saved. But it also predicted severe hardship and many victims. The events which could enter into the history of the color revolutions as the most massive human sacrifice yet arrived right on schedule, 1 month later.
For weeks, this European capital has been the scene of a violent uprising. Today, the bloodiest day yet.
The protesters are pushing up towards the government district, armed here with Molotov cocktails, but we saw handguns and shotguns too. There are casualties on both sides.
Well, she's just said that there are six dead people up there. Not just injured, dead. They say they've been hit by snipers.
And here again, we meet our old acquaintance from Narodny Rukh, Andriy Paruby, who is at the peak of his glory as self-proclaimed commandant of Maidan, which basically means the leader of the radical opposition.
The protesters were filmed leading a long line of riot police away. It's not clear where they were taking them. 67 officers are currently reported to be missing.
14 policemen dead and 43 wounded.
Earlier, from inside the protest camp, the opposition leader Vitali Klitschko urged his supporters to stay put. Each of you here should stay strong in spirit, he said, because we're not going anywhere.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
I feel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We've spoken about marriage a few times before, and here when we're talking about relationships with your kin, with your family members, obviously you are going to have to deal with the topic of your spouse. The first part of this discussion is on how you are able to deal with your wife, and the second part is how to deal with your husband. In the previous episode, we covered the topic of your relationship with your spouse, with your wife, emphasizing on the wife side, today the husband side, and how a husband needs to treat his wife and deal with affairs related to his wife. Clearly, there are a lot more that can be discussed. Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli has spoken about this with as much concise brevity as possible, but for those interested, you need to delve into this topic more It is indeed a very, very important area which we all need to remind ourselves of, whether we are going to get married, whether we are in our early stages of marriage, or whether we've been married for a very long time. We still need to continue to remember the foundations of what brings about a happy relationship, a happy household, under the shadow of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, living with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and living with nobleness, and making sure that we are not only fulfilling that level of tranquility that we all want and harmony that we all want, but also making sure that we set ourselves as good examples for others as well. As for the topic of dealing with your husband, your relationship with a wife's relationship with her husband, seeing that we want to excel, seeing that we want to be the best of people, seeing that our ambitions, our goals are more towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala than towards the material, physical gains of this dunya. So the process of thinking that we have is always towards al-akhirah. And we're always remembering that there are going to be difficulties here in this dunya. Al-dunya sijnul mu'min. This dunya is a jail for a believer. So we are going to have problems. We are going to have hardships. The reason why I am saying this is because it's easier for a wife to conform to her husband than for a husband to conform to his wife. And that's the sad reality, unfortunately, because husbands or men in general usually are more stubborn, are more adamant about, are more opinionated, want to put their foot down more, see that it's within their manhood and their masculinity that they need to, you know, always be right and things like that.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
That's what we need to change. We need to change this kind of approach. We need to understand that it works both sides. Yes, Islam does say that the manager of the house, that affairs, general affairs, the director, you know, the boss, the president, the pilot, the captain is going to be the husband within the perimeters and affairs of what he is specialized in, of what he is good in. And then it's for the wife to assist, to cooperate in the affairs that she is good in as well. And as long as there is never going to be dhulm, there's never going to be any oppression. The husband never oppresses the wife. The wife never oppresses the husband. Everything is going to be good and positive. Once that line is crossed. Once there is oppression and there is wronging, you can't use verses from the Quran to support your dhulm or a hadith to support your dhulm. It's never going to justify what it is that you are doing. Ultimately, there will be a day of hisab and kitab, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's hisab is indeed asir. There is going to be severe punishment, especially for al-zalimeen. We need to remember this all the time, because Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, he says, al-mar'atu rayhana wa laysat biqahramana. We need to have riqqa, we need to be soft, we need to be kind, we need to be generous. We always need to be reminded as well that the wife, our wives, your wife is an amana entrusted to you by her family. So we need to remember that as much as possible. Again, the same way as men need to get married, and also as early as possible, you know, once you hit that legal age, you need to start planning for marriage. Not planning only financially, but also planning in your maturity, also planning in your religiosity, in your religious understanding of making sure you make the right selection, you choose the right spouse, you learn the talents of building a family and a household, because it indeed is a skill and a talent. Look at the statistics of divorce. You only need to look at the statistics of divorce for you to understand where are people going wrong. In my opinion, the first thing, the first place where people are going wrong is the selection. The selection process is very un-Islamic, far from Islam. The second is that learning of the skill of how you are able to be a good wife, how you are able to be a good husband. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. والصلاة والسلام على أشرف خلق الله محمد وآله الطاهرين.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children's screams.
There was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty windowpane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart, there will always be there, be there.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini al-Islami, dini wal-Azam, ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Going to talk about the rules and jurisprudential status of hijab according to Ayatollah Khamenei in this episode and hopefully in the upcoming episodes consecutively. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. SubhanAllah.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are going to talk about some of the jurisprudential rules or laws, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, about hijab. And we started this concept from the last episode onwards, inshallah. And let me ask you, Sheikh Javid, with this question at the beginning of this episode, that it happens to a lot of people when they want to, in fact, take some driving classes, all right?
Yeah.
And especially I'm talking about women who have to join some of the classes, and for their practical dimension of the driving test, they have to, in fact, drive the car with the help of a non-mahram, for example, instructor, yes. Right? So is it permissible for a woman, in fact, even if she observes the hijab and chastity throughout the whole class in the car, staying actually or being alone, for example, with a non-mahram instructor, all right, teaching her, for example, some driving lessons?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. According to Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, there is no objection to learning driving with the help of a non-mahram instructor, provided that she observes hijab and chastity and ensures that actually no negative or vile consequences are there, or you know, no haram thing is going to be committed, and she is confident that she will not fall into a sin. Because if it's feared that she will fall into a sin, then it's not permissible to for her to be in the same car with a non-mahram.
Mm-hmm.
And Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that, of course, it is advisable that one among her mahram should accompany her. For example, if she has a brother, or if she is married and her husband is there, it is very much recommended that she be accompanied by one of her mahram relatives. And it is even much better that if she learns driving with the help of female instructor, because we, for example, in some countries there are female instructors, and of course if there are one such instructor, it is, you know, much better for her to turn to such instructors and not go to a male trainer or a male instructor.
Yes.
Yeah, to learn driving.
Okay. Sheikh Javid, we know that in educational, for example, or academic spheres or circles, university students socialize and associate with each other very much. And sometimes it ranges from their subjects that they study to lots of other things, sometimes unrelated. For example, they even, they tell some light-hearted jokes, for example, all right, to each other. But, of course, even if it is not with a questionable intention or sexual pleasure, all right, is it permissible for students to mingle and socialize like this at universities?
Yeah. Well, there is no objection to being together. For example, university students of both sexes meeting each other or discussing scientific issues, you know, as long as, you know, they are confident and that they will not fall into a sin, and of course, as long as the female students observe proper hijab, because hijab is mandatory and it's obligatory. And also, more importantly, the question, the intention is also very important, you know. When there is no, you know, questionable intention involved, just as you rightly mentioned, and one is immune from corrupting practices, from haram things, from mischievous, from falling into a sin, then it is permissible coming together. But it's precautionary, of course. not to engage and not to, you know, break jokes with girls and, mm-hmm. you know.
Or silly talk.
These you know, jokes sometimes lead to, you know, vile consequences.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes. I see. Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our episode of Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Jawad, our guest speaker. We are talking about Ayatollah Khamenei's views on the laws of hijab or hijab-related issues. With Sheikh Jawad. You know, what is the ruling in the case of looking at pictures of or photos of non-mahram women who are not wearing hijab, you know? What does Ayatollah Khamenei say on viewing, for example, women on that they appear on television, for example? Is this ruling different whether these women are Muslims or non-Muslims, or whether it is, for example, a live broadcast or not?
Well, that's a good question. I've come across these questions and have come across people asking this question. You know, they wonder as to whether it's permissible for them to look at those women without hijab on TV and when the program is broadcast live. So, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, of course, looking at the picture of non-mahram women does not have the ruling of looking at the woman herself, because when a woman is in front of you, you look at that woman who is sitting in front of you. But for example, if there is a woman being if there is a woman's picture, mm-hmm. and you see that picture, of course they are not the same, you know. The same is the case with a woman you watch or see on television. Of course, there's no objection to watching such pictures or such movies, unless looking is, of course, accompanied by lust or some kind of lustful intention. You know, if there is a fear of falling, you know, victim to some kind of temptation, then it's not permissible to look at the picture as well, because if you look at the picture with lustful intention, it does not make any difference whether the picture is broadcast live, mm-hmm. or it is broadcast from an archive. It does not make any difference. So what is important is for a Muslim woman, for a Muslim man, in fact, to protect himself from watching things with lustful intention. As long as there's no such intention, of course, it is permissible.
Does the same ruling apply to whether you're looking at mahram or non-mahram? I mean, like Muslim and non-Muslim women?
Of course, you know, we have the liberty to see non-mahram, non-Muslim women who do not, you know, observe hijab and who are not in the habit of covering themselves. Of course, as long as we do not have lustful intention, there is no problem. And also there is, you know, a difference between live broadcast and, you know, when something is broadcast live. You know, Ayatollah Khamenei says that one should not view pictures of non-mahram women on television that are broadcast live, provided that, you know, if there is such an intention, you mm-hmm. know, there is such intention, of course, one should not. And then, he says that if a program is not broadcast live, there is no problem in watching it and seeing pictures and provided that it is done without ill intention, without lustful intention, and one is confident that he is not going to fall into a sin.
Okay, thank you very much, Shavit, for your nice contribution to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. And thank you, dear listeners, for listening to this program. We say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh. Till next time.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
Çömen. Yani...
Bazaar.
Gas powers production, and oil greases the gears of the industry. Without gas and oil, most industries probably wouldn't thrive as they are today. The world consumes around 36 billion barrels of oil per year. Oil and gas are major industries in the energy market and play a significant role in the global economy as the world's primary fuel source. Meanwhile, the process and systems involved in producing and distributing oil and gas are highly complex. They require lots of money and state-of-the-art technology.
Hello there. Welcome to another edition of Bazaar. Today, we'll venture through Iran's oil and gas industry. This sector is massive, and its enormity doesn't quite sink in until you visit one of the industry's annual exhibits. So, we visited the country's 26th International Oil, Gas, Refining and Petrochemical Exhibition, dubbed the Iran Oil and Gas Show. We'll explore this sector's development and uncover why it's essential to the national economy. What are we waiting for? Let's get to it.
The Oil and Gas Show is one of the largest exhibitions in the global oil industry. It takes place every year and serves as a place for domestic and foreign industry participants to interact. The exhibition is based on the theme of knowledge-based oil, Iranian production, and global exports. It is based on this year's economic goal set by Iran's leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The leader has emphasized strengthening the knowledge-based economy by adopting a scientific and technical approach in all fields. The exhibition showcases the latest products made by Iranian knowledge-based firms. It's a platform for expanding business markets and finding potential customers and suppliers, among other things. We caught up with a few participants to see what types of products and services they offered in this sector. This company manages an entire oil field in southern Iran. Moreover, it engineers machines and compressors needed for refining and processing crude oil and gas products.
Petro Iran Development Company, Petco, is one of the subsidiaries of NIOC, and we are acting as an E&P and GC contractor, and we are involved in several upstream and downstream projects, mainly in Iran and even abroad. The 26th oil and gas show was one of the biggest show during the past even 10 years. As I noticed during these 3 days, there were very good participation of foreign companies. And these foreign companies, it was my surprise that they are not seeking for actually individual work by themselves. They are looking for actually cooperative, actually joint ventures with Iranian companies. And because we have a very good, capable Iranian manufacturers and contractors, and I have seen lots of agreements that have been signed during these 3 days. There are very big opportunities for investment in Iran because of nowadays situation in the world. There are a very massive request, demand for Iranian oil and Iranian actually industry, manufacturers and contractors. And as it was noticed in this fair, more than 8 billion euros of actually investment agreement was signed. And I think that it, we have this opportunity to actually up to 20 billion euros of investment to sign with the Iranian and even foreign countries.
Another pavilion displayed the cutting-edge technology used in downstream and upstream oil industries. This company is also developing various oil fields and supplying electrical power.
Each year, scores of people and industry participants visit and hold pavilions in this exhibit. Such events also provide unique access to leading decision makers in the oil and gas industry. Additionally, it is a place for knowledge exchange and determining current needs and future development vectors. This year, the fair opened with 1,200 Iranian and 44 foreign exhibitors from 11 countries.
Another benefit of the fair is networking and creating new business opportunities throughout the energy sector with prospective business agreements. A significant number of business deals were closed during the 3-day oil and gas show. There is a lot of potential for investment in the oil and gas industry. This exhibit provides chances to link investors with potential joint ventures in this field. It's noteworthy that 23 universities and research centers and over 100 knowledge-based companies, startups, and technology parks participated in this event. High-profile representatives of foreign companies from 22 countries were present at the show too. The most notable was the Secretary General of the Gas Exporting Countries Forum, Mohammad Hamal. Other important figures included the Minister of Oil, Javad Oji, Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf, and the Head of Parliament's Energy Committee, Feridun Hasanvand. The sprawling fairgrounds were packed with all sorts of equipment and machinery used in the oil and gas industry. These ranged from advanced technology for extraction, processing, storage, transport, safety systems, and control technology. We spoke with a representative of a company specializing in producing composite pipes, which are high in demand in this sector. Iran's oil and gas industry is thriving and has taken giant strides in production. It owes its many successes largely to knowledge-based companies and research institutions that have offered their services in developing this sector. Expanding the gas and oil industry has been at the top of the government's agenda for years. Over time, it has implemented several measures to this end. The government is focusing on knowledge-based firms and research companies as the bedrock of developing the oil and gas sector. The Oil Ministry has outlined several goals to tap into the high capacities of knowledge-based firms to boost production in the oil and gas sector. These goals are optimizing production, overhauling production facilities, and value chain developments. This goes hand in hand with the domestic development of innovative technologies. So, the government is supporting knowledge-based firms and startups and their efforts to manufacture commodities and equipment required in the oil and gas industry.
Finding investors, whether domestic or international, is a top priority for the government. Iran is rich with oil and gas reserves and is the fourth largest oil producer among OPEC members.
Plus, Iran possesses the third largest oil reserves in the world. So it's not surprising that the government would want to find ways to exploit its potential.
The oil ministry has inked 50 agreements and memoranda of understanding worth nearly $17 billion in the first 9 months of last year alone. These deals were with petrochemical holdings, banks, and negotiating with reputable international companies. The agreements mainly focus on developing joint oil and gas fields, flare gas collections, and developing value chains. It plans on using knowledge-based companies and domestic manufacturing potentials to this end. The Minister of Oil, Javad Oji, says exhibits like the Oil and Gas Show reflect Iran's capability and authority despite sanctions. Oji also explains that Iran's gas and oil sector is steadily inching forward and is proving the failure of the US sanction policies. The official highlighted that the Oil and Gas Show displays the country's resiliency and its ability to diversify its economy through energy diplomacy. The minister expressed optimism for the future of this industry as there are grounds for returning to the energy trade. Oji says this can happen through gas swap deals, finding new markets for oil and its byproducts, and exporting technical engineering services. All things considered, there is a bright future for Iran's oil market and industry. Plus, it offers numerous lucrative investment opportunities in downstream and upstream sectors. The need for home appliances dates back to the early stages of human existence, when cave dwellers began developing tools to preserve and prepare food. Today, home technology has become more sophisticated to match our fast-paced lifestyles. The level of convenience and comfort of home is also determined by these items, and they have even become a status symbol for some. In a sense, home appliances define modern living, changing the means of dealing with food, clothing, cleaning, and so much more.
This week, we're going to dive into the world of home appliance production. We want to see who the major players are in this industry and see how the market is doing. We will also uncover some of the major contributions of the home appliance industry to the country's economy as a whole.
Our journey this time took us to Abbasabad Industrial City on the outskirts of the capital Tehran. There, we visited a company that specializes in the production of home appliances. Emerson was established some 40 years ago and has become a household name in this industry. In the early days of its activity, it started out by making freezers. Over the years, it has expanded its product list and now manufactures refrigerators, cookers, and washing machines, among a long list of other items. This company has expansive production halls, which house its chain production machinery. Each production hall is tasked with a certain process of manufacturing, such as preparing material for assembling. From start to finish, everything happens at the production lines. Having an assembly line in the manufacturing process helps keep production processes regimented. This ensures the uniform production of items. It might be interesting to know that this company uses the latest computer-assisted robotic equipment in its production halls to get the job done. Automating processes help guarantee that each step is performed with uniform standards throughout. The other advantage is it allows quality control checks and implementation of standards to be performed with speed and accuracy. An integral part of this company is its research and development department. It is strategically intertwined with the production space. Products here are randomly pulled and tested at different stages. But that's not all. This advanced department also collaborates with foreign companies in research. Its production lines produce hundreds of home appliances each day. With this in mind, it has also provided hundreds of job opportunities. The company employs expert technical engineers and experienced workers to manage designs and machines. This company has a unique outlook toward the future and is continuously looking for more ways to foster growth opportunities. As part of its future vision, it hopes to expand its reach and gain a larger share in the international market by increasing its product portfolio. Like many in the manufacturing business, the US sanctions have caused some challenges for this company, but this firm was able to turn these challenges into major opportunities for growth.
As you might know, local home appliance brands in this sector also compete with foreign ones. Iranian manufacturers produce the same quality of home appliances as their international competitors, yet many in the country still seem to be drawn to foreign names. It might be interesting to do a little price comparison here.
Iran's culture and traditions play a big role in consumer trends. For example, newlyweds are expected to move into a home fully furnished with brand new items. The budget needed to furnish a home can cost upwards of $30,000 depending on the decision to purchase foreign brands. However, the budget needed to purchase Iranian brands for ordinary items is far less. One would need a budget of around $10,000 to get it done. For example, the cost of an average two-door Iranian brand refrigerator is roughly $350. The same standard double-door refrigerator made by a Korean brand is roughly $2,500 when purchased in Iran. That is, of course, based on the daily exchange rate of 30,000 tumans to the dollar. In 2018, the government banned the import of foreign brands. Nevertheless, these brands were still seen in the domestic market. This was partly due to existing stockpiles of previous imports. The government implemented the initiative aiming at strengthening domestic production and sales. But this gave rise to a lucrative black market of smuggled home appliances, which is still being regulated. Trafficked goods have been reduced in recent years. However, they still find their way into the domestic market.
Companies like the one we just mentioned are at the helm of this industry. Currently, there are some 80,000 home appliance manufacturing units in the country. Their domestic productions have not only helped satisfy local needs, but also saved the country millions on imports. Officials say the country is now self-sufficient in terms of the production of these items.
Iran's home appliance manufacturers were operating below their potential capacities around 2018. Before the ban on imports, some 85% of foreign brands available in the country were domestically produced under foreign licenses. The necessary infrastructure existed, but there was little domestic demand due to the competition with foreign brands. Based on figures from the Electrical, Metal and Home Appliance Office of the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade, the 2018 import ban was effective. Data from the office shows last year Iran produced over 15 million home appliance units. This is 3 million units more than the government's target of last year and double the production figure of 2018. Officials with the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade say indigenizing home appliance parts has reduced imports by $500 million. Such an increase in production also means that home appliance exports skyrocketed. Last year, $140 million worth of these items were exported, and the government hopes to push this figure to $200 million this year. Some industry participants argue one way to increase quality and expand Iran's home appliance market is by lifting the ban on imports. They say the industry has grown by leaps and bounds in recent years, adding it is capable of growing stronger through serious local and international competition. Others argue that it's too soon to lift the ban, as more steps need to be taken to strengthen domestic infrastructure for manufacturing home appliances.
Well, it looks like it's time for me to take a little break and pass the action over to my good friend and colleague out there on the field. Take it away.
Water. It's a vital liquid for every life form on planet Earth. We drink it to quench our thirst, but is that the only use? Well, let me tell you that it is not. We can use it in different industries, such as oil and gas, petrochemicals. And today, we are here at a company that works in different areas, like the ones that I mentioned. And one of the things that they produce is related to the water industry.
Atiye Pardozan Sharif Company was established 11 years ago. It's active in key industries such as oil and gas and petrochemicals. They have also managed to cooperate with power plants and steel industry companies. This group has sufficient experience and expertise in designing, optimizing, and manufacturing electrolyzers, as well as designing and creating chlorine plants for seawater and saltwater systems. They have provided jobs for 170 individuals directly and some 200 people indirectly. Using the scientific capital of the graduates of top universities and the experience of skilled specialists in the oil and gas industry and water and wastewater process units in the field of design, construction, installation, pre-commissioning and full operation of electrochlorination units in marine catchments, water and wastewater treatment plants, power plants, petrochemicals, and domestic and foreign refineries, this company is very experienced.
Okay, raw material is brought in into the company, then they turn them into things such as plates that are assembled in the line. Now, when the assembly is done, what you see is a seawater electrolyzer cell. Where we use it, I will explain it for you a little bit later. After that, all these things are transferred to protective shields. What do they do? Actually, they protect that equipment. After that, they are transferred to another section for packaging and shipping. So let's go and find out more.
Electrochlorination is the electrolysis of saline water inside an electrolyzer by the application of an electric current. The electrolyzer consists of a set of electrodes in which seawater flows. In this process, chlorine gas is produced at the sodium hydroxide cathode. Sodium hydroxide and chlorine gas then react with each other to form sodium hypochlorite solution.
The final part. Everything is ready for shipping. Something very important about this company is that these products are all produced from 0 to 100 in Iran. They transfer water from Persian Gulf, for instance, to provinces with dry climate. And this helps to disinfect water. Until a couple of years ago, Iranian companies had to import these equipment. But now, thanks to this company, they can buy it at a very good price and use it in their companies.
The research and development unit of the company has been using the latest scientific findings of the world and constantly observed latest technology production trends to improve industry's units' performance. As a result, they have managed to introduce several knowledge-based technologies to the market to solve the problems of industrial units.
Okay, I was talking to an expert in this lab. What do they do here? Well, after research and development and production, they take samples from the final products and test their quality because they do pay attention to details. I guess that's the end of today's report. Thank you.
Many thanks for that awesome adventure. We learned a lot from that. We still have a bit of time left, though, in the program, so let's look at some news and trends in Iran's gas and oil sector. Here we go. Iran's gas distribution network is quite advanced and has a very high capacity for transferring this hydrocarbon. Currently, the country is set to swap gas with its neighbours to the north.